The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Writer Hilary Mantel called Alex Marr's new book, 70x7, a deeply researched, deeply felt, and absorbing work of social history, and a story about the mystery and miracle of forgiveness. It is a book of awesome scope, and it deserves to be read with attention. Alex Marr's other work includes Witches of America, a 5-year journalistic foray into modern-day occult belief and her own relationship to mysticism, and American Mystic, her feature-length documentary film about members of fringe religious sects, which premiered to wide acclaim at the 2010 Tribeca Film Festival. Tonight, Ms. Marr will be in conversation with Shane Claiborne of Red Letter Christians and co-founder of The Simple Way, a Philadelphia-based nonprofit that works in the new monastic tradition to live, minister, and improve its Kensington community. Please welcome our guests.
Well, this is exciting. I didn't have to come too far. I told Alex I just came from Kensington, where that's been my home for the last couple of decades, and I am so excited about 70x7. We've been together a few times, but this is really special to have you in Philly. So, welcome to the City of Love.
Thank you. I was saying to Shane backstage that I think the first time I ever saw him was in D.C., and he was beating a gun into a gardening tool in a dramatic presentation against gun violence. And then I think possibly the next time I saw you, you were maybe getting arrested for protesting the death penalty on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. Does that sound about right?
I can neither confirm nor deny that fact. Yeah.
So this is a man who gets up to some good trouble, so to speak, as John Lewis would say.
Well, and, you know, a lot of that is right in the stream of the subject of this wonderful book. Bill Pelkey, who we'll talk about, started some of the direct action on the death penalty. But, you know, first, I've written some, and one of my mentors said to me, don't write unless you can not write. Like, let the books choose you. And so there's all kinds of stuff that you've written on. There's all kinds of stuff you could have written a book on. How did this book choose you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not someone who usually writes about specifically criminal justice system, social justice issues. I tend to be drawn into stories by the people I meet, their relationships. And in this case, I was actually doing some research into criminal justice, specifically violent crimes committed by women, because they're far more rare. I was just looking for patterns, trying to just educate myself, see what I found. And along the way, I encountered this story of the murder of Ruth Pelkey, an elderly woman who was a Bible teacher in Gary, Indiana, in 1985, who had been killed by Paula Cooper, a 15-year-old girl. This was a very violent crime that took place during a kind of robbery gone wrong, home invasion scenario. And I was so struck by Paula's age, how young she was, and yet she committed this violent act. But also I was struck by the fact that she was then sentenced to death for it, even though she was just 15. And then to top that off, a few months after her death sentence, the victim, Ruth Pelkey's grandson, Bill Pelkey, chose, against the wishes of his family and his friends, of the members of the church he went to, his coworkers, really totally on his own, he decided to publicly forgive Paula. And I had never heard of anyone doing something like that at that point. So it just really stopped me in my tracks, and I wanted to know more. So I looked up Bill's number and I gave him a call, and that was the beginning of, you know, 5 years of research.
When I first encountered Bill, it was when I saw a piece on CNN. I think it was on a news channel just telling the story of that forgiveness, and I think it captured a lot of people's imagination, because when you think of the death penalty, you know, one of the first things people ask is, what about the victims? And it's exactly the right question. But Bill kind of changes, I mean, his story changes the way that we think about victims, because he was a work in progress. Like, initially, he wanted the death penalty, but then began to think about what his grandmother would want as a Sunday school teacher that taught about Jesus and forgiveness, and then found himself at odds with his family. So, I wonder if you want to say a little bit about, his own journey of forgiveness.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I got to know Bill, I was so fascinated by him as this complex man. When the crime took place, he was 39 years old, and he'd not really made any waves in his life. He just wanted to go to work at the steel mill, do his shifts. He was a crane operator there in Portage, Indiana, and he'd been doing that for ages. He served in Vietnam, but he didn't have any particular political feelings about it. You know, he just went about his business. When this crime happened, he agreed with his family that, you know, the prosecutor has said, we're going to go for the death penalty, and that is the right thing to do because it is the most severe punishment available. And what happened to your grandmother is, it's important, it's significant. This is a terrible, heinous crime, and we want to respect her by sentencing this girl to death. Mm. His father, the rest of his family, felt on board with this. They were devout, fundamentalist Baptist family, and they believed that there was sort of an Old Testament justice in this, and Bill agreed. But a few months went by, and he was going through a really rough time in his life, grieving his grandmother. His longtime girlfriend had just left him. He had just declared bankruptcy. His life was really a mess. And he just thought, you know, I have been such a disappointment. I have been such a disappointment. I feel so low and so alone. And it was on a late shift at the mill one night. He was up in the crane cab. The warehouse was empty. He was waiting to get instructions for the shift. And it's quiet and dark in there, and he's just thinking about what a mess he's made of his life. And he had this flash of imagining Paula Cooper, of all people. He had not been thinking about her. He knew what she looked like. He was there the day she was sentenced in court. He pictured her this time in a cell on death row, you know, whatever that might look like in his mind. And he thought, wow, it's probably as small as this crane cab I'm sitting in. And she's lonelier than I will ever be, and she is more desperate than I will ever be. And he found himself moved and crying on her behalf, and he thought, you know what? My grandmother would not want us to execute this girl in her name. She would want me to forgive her. And you know what? I've disappointed a lot of people. I don't want to disappoint my grandmother. I'm going to find a way to have that kind of compassion. And he left that shift that night actually with direction in his life for the first time. And the next day, he sat down on his break at work. He went and he got some of that printer paper out of his foreman's office, and he got a ballpoint pen, and he just thought, you know, what if I write her a letter? What am I going to say to the girl who killed my grandmother? I'll come up with something. And he wrote her a note that said, you know, hi, I'm Bill Pelkey. Ruth was my grandmother. Essentially, I forgive you. I want to try to help you out. Let me know what I can do. Which is a really radical move.
Yeah. And it's a little tricky because you don't want to get to the whole, you got the spoiler thing. You don't want to tell the whole story, but but I think it is this, the humanity of this young woman comes across, you know, in the, the court transcripts, which you said you know you read over these over and over, and I wanted to read this one little excerpt because this is during the trial, and Paula Cooper talks about she's really owning up to what she did, but she's also pointing out the kind of glaring paradox that this same court is getting ready to kill her to try to show that killing is wrong. And she says, "Everybody put the blame on me. Well, where was all these people now? Right here, when I needed somebody. Where was they at? They turned their backs on me and took me through all this. All I can say is, now look where I'm at now, facing a possible death sentence." And then she says, "I know justice must be done. And whatever the consequences, whatever your decision is," she's saying this to the judge, "I will accept it, even if it's death. I can't change things right now. And I'm very sorry for what I did. I hope that one day I can get out and start my life over. I hope that one day I can get my life together. Maybe I can finish school. I haven't even finished school. Will I have a chance? Will I ever get a chance?" And this is a teenager, right, that like is faced the death penalty, I think, right, as the only juvenile female ever to get the death penalty, and they're wrestling with all that. So yeah.
In the Midwest, certainly, and you know, this was a very extreme scenario for this judge to be in as well. He's got this teenage girl sitting there, and her representation was so poor that he couldn't see any other way to follow. But you know, if he were to follow the law, respect the law, death penalty state, he had to give her the death sentence, right? And what she's referring to in that part of her statement, you know, where were you all before? She and her older sister Rhonda, from a very young age, you know, they were living in a chaotic household. Their father was physically abusive. Their mother had a very terrible drinking problem. And the parents were otherwise often absent. You know, the girls ran away from home multiple times. They were put in emergency shelters. They were put in foster care. They asked a social worker, you know, "You've got to get us out of this house." Paula one night went to the police station and said, "You know, I've been physically beaten. I don't want to go home." They were continually sent back. And Paula had been sent back home just a few weeks before the crime occurred. And so for me, when she's saying that, she's talking about, you know, here we are. This is a really extreme situation. But no one was this concerned when it was just about two girls and their safety. That's not to excuse the crime at all, but I did think it was important to talk about where this young woman was coming from at that point in her life. And I tried to give a lot of dimension to the different characters in the story. So, you know, we get to know Paula and her sister. We get to know Bill and his family. But I also, you know, tried to give a lot of care in my portrait, even of the prosecutor who went for death, because everyone in this story thinks they represent the right way to go about things, right? So something that was really fascinating is when Paula was sentenced to death, the headlines were about the violence of the crime. Mm-hmm. The headlines in Lake County in Indiana were not about how can we sentence a teenage girl to the electric chair. It wasn't until the fact of her death sentence made it into the European media. And, you know, journalists in Italy and Germany were criticizing that decision in the U.S., that the American media started to change their tune and say, well, okay, is this scandalous? Maybe we need to think about this case a little bit differently. And the course of events became a lot more complicated. And the discussion around justice in this case became a lot more complicated.
So when Bill sent that when he began this relationship, this courageous relationship with Paula, it wasn't just a one-off letter, I forgive you, but it started this ongoing friendship, like this courageous relationship of trying to be love that would heal those wounds. That's what Bill said all the time, is that love and compassion is the answer. You know, this love and compassion that he began to show to Paula Cooper. So talk a little bit about what that looked like for when she was incarcerated and he began a relationship with her, and then eventually, you know, was willing to step in as she was released.
So this struck me as really the heart of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that Bill Pelkey, who was a 40-year-old white man, steel worker, union guy, reaches out to this young black girl from an unstable home who was, you know, that time had just turned 16. What do they have in common? Mm-hmm. Never mind the fact that she was just convicted of killing his family member. What is that relationship? Paula writes back eventually to that first letter, and she sounds kind of like an angry teenager. She's overwhelmed. She's on death row. She doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know what to do. And she expresses to Bill not gratitude for his forgiveness at first, but anger that his family would want her dead. Mm-hmm. Right? And she just sounds so young and upset and in that moment incapable of understanding what he's trying to do, and maybe a little suspicious of him. Mm-hmm. What's his angle? Who forgives in that situation? But over time, they wrote back and forth every single week for a long period. Over years, there were hundreds of letters, and I had a chance to read almost all of them. And you see their relationship deepening, and they actually begin to trust each other. And Bill's offering life advice to Paula. You know, he sends her tape cassettes to listen to in the mail. Soon she's offering him some life advice. He's saying, you know, I don't know what's going on with my wife, Judy. She gets mad at me about this. And she goes, well, you know, Bill, I think when you love someone, you have to let them feel free. And like, giving this grown man advice. And I think it speaks to how unique and how private their correspondence was. Mm-hmm. And that to me was... It really knocked my socks off. I'd never encountered a relationship like that. And at the same time, you know, she came to understand that this man really is working to save my life. Every chance he could, he was talking to the press in the States and in Europe and saying, I know what the prosecutor wanted. I know that he got the death sentence. My grandmother would not have wanted that in this case. We don't believe in the death penalty. And on top of that, this is a kid.
Yeah.
And it ended up really giving new energy to her appeals case when her appeal was working its way through the court in Indiana.
Mm. Let's talk just a little bit about the title, because it also, first maybe share about where the title comes from, because it's a, you know, very intriguing title for someone that hadn't read the book yet, 70 times 7. So, yeah.
Well, I love this title in that it probably is mysterious to some readers, its meaning, and to others they'll get the reference right away. So it is a reference to a moment in the Gospel of Matthew that meant a lot to Bill Pelkey, in which the disciple Peter asked Jesus, how many times am I supposed to forgive someone who harms me? Seven times? And Jesus says, you know, I'm not saying seven, 70 times seven. Right? So you need to be prepared to forgive numerous, numerous times as a way of life. And Bill took that to heart. To me, I made that the title because I think it's an incredible challenge. Mm. I don't know that I can live up to that idea. I don't know that I'd be able to do what Bill Pelkey did in his situation. And I think it's a lot to ask of anyone. Mm-hmm. So that is what a lot of people at the heart of this book are wrestling with throughout this story.
It also raises the question that's a little bit of a theme in the book, but certainly if you take a deep dive looking at the death penalty, there's competing narratives of Christianity, and the biggest supporters for the death penalty in America are evangelical Christians. 95% of executions happen in the Bible Belt. So these states that, like where I grew up in Tennessee, where we still have the electric chair, South Carolina is right now trying to bring back the firing squad. They're the same states that held on to slavery the longest, but they're also the Bible Belt. And even in this story itself, you see the Bible being used as a justification for the death penalty, but you also see a different version that Bill embodies, which is this seven times, 70 times seven, this forgiveness, this Jesus that said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." What his grandmother taught her Sunday school students. So, do you want to say more about that, like kind of competing versions of Christianity and how it worked itself out?
Well, in this story, that was something that I thought was really fascinating. You know, one question I was really grappling with personally is when you're in this kind of extreme situation or any extreme challenging situation in life, what do you fall back on? What tells you how to respond, right? Is it the faith you were raised with? Is it the faith you found later in life? Is it your belief in the letter of the law? You know, what gives you the moral instinct of, you know, in terms of how to respond? Bill's family, as I mentioned, Baptist, they supported the death penalty. He was raised Baptist, and he said, no, you know, I'm going to interpret that completely differently. I believe that my faith is about forgiveness, ultimately. The prosecutor was Catholic, and yet he was prepared to go for death, right? And one of Paula's most passionate appellate attorneys was actually someone, a fantastic woman named Monica Foster, who gave this case her all. And she described herself to me as a flaming atheist. And she said, "I don't know. I just fight for mercy. It's just a thing I do." Mm. She didn't have an explanation for it. So, you know, I want to turn that question back to you, Shane, because you are a vocal Christian, a vocal progressive evangelical. You're so involved in social justice and especially around the death penalty. I've seen you so many times standing up about this issue. How do you feel when you hear this aspect of the story and this kind of disagreement amongst people where, you know, you might assume they would agree on such a life and death issue, right?
Yeah. Well, we're not here for me, Alex, but I do. I will say that.
It's a cop
out. I think I spent a good chunk of my life supporting the death penalty with all the Bible verses that I believed backed it up. And a couple things happened. I began to take a closer look at both the theology that I had used as kind of a weapon. But I also looked at what Jesus said and tried to reconcile it with some of the other things I saw in Scripture. And I think, you know, at the heart of this issue and in the heart of Bill's story is the question, is anybody beyond redemption? You know, as Brian Stevenson, he's, you know, spent a lot of time here in Philadelphia. He's a death penalty lawyer, the subject of the film Just Mercy, and wrote the book Just Mercy. He says, we're all more than the worst thing that we've ever done. So the death penalty doesn't allow room for mercy or grace. And it's why, you know, Pope Francis has been such an adamant, he says it's an absolute contradiction of the things that Jesus lived and died for. But I think it's hard to get folks there. And that's why I love the power of story, is I think a lot of people's heart moves before their head moves, you know, and that's what this book does. As I read it, though, and as you continue to wrestle with Bill's story, one of the things that really converted me too is that there are tons of murder victims' family members that have come to see that violence is the problem, not the solution. That we're not going to heal violence with more violence. And that you know, the death penalty kind of imitates the very evil that we're trying to heal the world of. And that's what Bill embodied and preached so powerfully. Yeah, but as you read the story, I just wanted to make that point that it feels like this is an exceptional story, but what Bill surfaced was an entire movement called the Journey of Hope, right? That's filled with murder victims' family members who are abolitionists, you know, want alternatives to the death penalty.
Yeah, there's a version of this book that might have started with the crime and ended with the end of Paula Cooper's case. Mm-hmm. But the story was bigger than that. So the book goes past that moment into work that Bill Pelkey ends up doing. You know, he had been, as I mentioned, he was someone who just had a very private, normal life, work-a-day rhythm to his life. And something really was ignited within him when he stood up for Paula. And when that case was settled, he thought, but this is bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And his wife at the time said, oh, no, are you going to go and try to save all the Paulas? Oh, God. You know, she realized this was going to be an enormous undertaking that he was embracing. But he was someone who had never met an activist in his life. All of a sudden, people are saying, oh, this is the ACLU. This is Amnesty International. He's showing up for rallies. He's going to marches. And he's the only guy in a pressed gray suit, carrying a Bible, looking around at the college kids and the hippies and thinking, oh, okay. Yeah. So, you know, it was dipping his toe into water that was new for him. And along the way, through that process, he began to meet, one by one, other people, like you say, who were murder victims' family members, who had chosen to speak out against the death penalty in their cases. And at great expense, they had also been treated as pariahs in their communities because of that. And together, little by little, they realized, you know what, we've got a voice in this system that needs to be heard. The assumption, I think for most of us too, is that the family of a victim is going to be in line with what the prosecutor wants. And we get a lot of that also from TV and film, right? You know that there's this mission to get justice, and the prosecutor represents that mission, and everyone's on the same team on that side, and they want to punish the defendant with the severest punishment possible. What happens when the family members are saying, you know, we don't even agree.
Yeah.
That's not what we want. That's not what our loved one would have wanted. It really throws a wrench in the works, and it's not something our system is built to accommodate. But, you know, related to that, and this was something I talked to some of the murder victims' family members about as well, is they were so aware, you know, multiple times Bill and others told me, the family on the other side, we have so much in common with them. So in Bill's case, it was him acknowledging, you know, Paula's grandfather, Paula's older sister, Rhonda, I have something in common with them. Mm-hmm. We're all human beings who've been thrown together by this horrible act of violence. If Paula's sentenced to death, they are going to be traumatized, hurt, and punished by that, and they've done nothing wrong. And so there's a commonality there that no one's allowed to explore in our system the way that it's built.
Yeah.
And this kind of reaching across the aisle, I think, is so powerful in this story. And I think, you know, for me, it made me think about other aspects of ways that we were quite divided in this country, right? Is there the potential for dialogue, even under extreme circumstances?
Yeah, and when you talk about, like, what's really going to change this and move towards the abolition of the death penalty, it's not staying in our silos and political camps, but it's getting out and creating conversations with people, especially in really conservative areas. And I mean, Bill organized a bus trip where they just piled onto a bus and drove through Texas and other places telling their stories. And they would have these packed audiences of conservative evangelical Christians that couldn't argue with their tears and their story and the way that they found forward, which was not by pursuing the death penalty. And some of those folks are the Journey of Hope's still a powerhouse. It's still, you know, doing all kinds of great work. And one of those co-founders is Suzanne Bosler, who you mentioned her, you know, that when the victim's family creates a kind of hiccup in the narrative, they become problematic. So in Suzanne's case, she felt her dad was a pastor and he was killed. And this was in Florida. She barely survived the crime. She was almost killed in the crime. And she walked away with that same conviction, similar to Bill's, that like the gospel that her dad preached was about love and forgiveness. And she didn't want the death penalty for the person. He definitely needed to be locked up. He was, you know, dangerous. And so she pursued that. But when it went to court, she was told that she could be held in contempt of court. And she was threatened with a fine. As the closest family member, I mean, and a survivor of the crime, she was silenced. So it is about the victims when the victims fit the narrative of what the, you know, the prosecutors want, and when they don't.
Right. It's this larger question of what's justice supposed to look like. Yeah. And in writing the book, I was really struck by how we just don't have a consensus on that. You know, we just don't. In a lot of cases, the sentences being handed down, you know, are they really making that community safer? Certainly sentencing a teenage, you know, one teenage girl to death in a city that was economically depressed, really kind of desperate, where crime was on the rise, that wasn't going to change that situation.
Yeah.
And the death penalty doesn't actually deter crime. We've found that out at this point, right? But I want to also say that this is a story that, you know, gets at these bigger questions and issues. But for me, my approach was always through these incredible characters. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that the story almost reads sort of like a novel, you know, where you're meeting these people, getting into their relationships and trying to, you're really getting inside why they decide to do what they do. And Bill and Paula's relationship is really the spine of the book. But beyond that, there's also this, I sort of think of it as kind of like the legal thriller storyline, which is all of these different attorneys. You know, one of them used to be a road worker and he became a public defender. He takes on Paula's appeal, along with Monica Foster, who was only a few years older than Paula Cooper herself when she started working on her case. She was so green and she was so passionate. And, you know, these people were part of the beginnings of a movement to not just get Paula off of death row, but to try to end the death penalty for kids in this country, which didn't come to an end until as recently as 2005.
Right.
So that, to me, was an amazing narrative to put together. So you've got these attorneys racing to make the deadline for the Supreme Court, racing to, you know, take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And these are all people connected to Paula's case. I found that pretty exciting to dramatize because that was a major shift in this country, that penalty was no longer on the table.
Yeah. So I've got just like one or two questions left, and then we're going to open it up. That's your heads up. But you mentioned, you know, some of Bill's work outside the U.S. He became so passionate about this. I mean, this became his life calling and his vocation, and he traveled all over the world working for the abolition of the death penalty. And there are some places that moved quicker than the United States, and I think that's, you know, kind of helpful to remember that the whole world has been wrestling with this question, do we kill to show that killing is wrong? And when I was born, I'll just throw it all out there, 1975, over 100 countries were using the death penalty. Now you fast forward just in my lifetime, almost all of the world has abolished the death penalty either in law or in practice. And there's only a handful of countries that are still actively executing. The United States is in the top 10 and often in the top five. It's like China, usually Iran and Iraq, Saudi Arabia, a few countries are in there, and the U.S. is right in the midst of that. So you look at like where we've come, and yet you mentioned this. I want to read this because it's important to remember that we've come a long way, but we still got a long way to go. And you said this, the first juvenile executed in the American colonies was a 16-year-old boy hanged in Massachusetts in 1642. By 1985, nearly 350 legal executions in the United States have been for crimes committed under the age of 18. And I began my book with the story of George Junius Stinney in Executing Grace, who was 14 years old when he was executed, and 70 years later was exonerated of that after, you know, he was killed. He was less than 100 pounds and actually had to sit on a Bible in order to be tall enough to face the electric chair. So this is our history that you kind of weave into this story. Do you want to say more about that? Because it seems like you're kind of uncovering some of that truth-telling about history as you tell Bill's story.
Someone who came on board with Paula's appeal was a professor, Victor Stribe. He was really a professor you would cast in a movie about, you know, the tweedy jacket and the little wire-rimmed glasses. And he preferred teaching at the time and writing scholarly articles to arguing in court. He was not someone who wanted to be a flashy attorney and make dramatic statements. He became really fascinated in the course of his research when he started doing a little bit of investigating into juvenile sentencing. And this was in the early 80s. And he said, you know, no one talks about the fact that we have capital punishment for kids. No one talks about it. And he started trying to compile data. You know, how many times have we sentenced someone young to death? Anytime he talked to a judge or a fellow attorney, they would say, yeah, but you know, that's like from colonial times or something. Like, no one does that anymore. And he discovered over time this figure that you came up with, that we have executed over 300 kids in this country. We've sentenced more than 200 to death since 1970. So at the time, these were numbers that no one knew about. And he developed this conviction that, you know what, I think a lot of people are comfortable with the death sentence because they don't really know the extent of what we're doing. And so he came on board with Paula's appeal, and he presented some of this data before the Indiana Supreme Court. And he then got involved, right before that, he got involved with the U.S. Supreme Court case, Thompson v. Oklahoma. He presented his data before the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices were shocked. This was incredibly convincing information to have in their hands. And so part of this story is also, you know, we need to just have an understanding of what's being done in our name. And I think more generally, I was really fascinated by this question of, if we're in a position to give the harshest sentence to a young person, back then it was the death sentence, today it's life without parole, right? We're the only country now that sentences kids to a lifetime in prison in certain cases. If we're willing to do that, are we really saying that almost no one is capable of rehabilitation? Almost no one is capable of evolving. No one deserves a second chance because these are people with decades of life ahead of them. So that to me is kind of the core issue there.
Yeah. And you know, we've evolved as a country on this issue. I mean, even in the U.S. in the colonies, we had the Salem witch trials, like, you know, witchcraft, sorcery, all these things were death-worthy crimes that actually had executions. It's tied to our race history, too. There were all kinds of things that African-Americans were executed for that weren't even crimes for white folks. And so there's, you know, and not executing people who were supposed to not be executing people that have intellectual disabilities. You know, there's been this kind of, like, growing curve, and yet we still have folks that were trying to move in it. And one of those folks that has changed their opinion is the new Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro. And it's interesting because he said, you might have seen this, he announced that here in Philadelphia, and what part of what moved him was he always, you know, most of us are going to agree, like, we shouldn't be executing minors, you know, we could, but still, in the worst case, are there some people that we need to hold the death penalty for? And that was the case for Governor Shapiro. He said, after the Tree of Life shooting, he's Jewish as well, and at the, you know, synagogue in Pittsburgh, here's someone that just filled with hate, opened fire and massacred so many people. And he, at the time, still thought we need the death penalty for people like that. But then he began meeting with the families that lost their loved ones. And it was, in part, talking with them and hearing them name the fact that violence is the problem, not the solution here, that kind of began to move him. He also talks about his son kind of asking him hard questions, his young boy, you know. But he announced just recently, a few weeks ago, that not only is he against the death penalty, but he's going to work really hard to try to close the door on it in Pennsylvania. So I don't know if you want to say more about, and this is it's a heart-wrenching story, but it's also a story full of hope. And Bill Pelkey is one of the most hopeful people I ever met. I mean, the fact they go to the heart of Texas and believe that people can change their mind. I mean, that's just who he was, you know.
I would just say, but you know, before we take questions, that I think that to me is really the takeaway of the book. There's some difficult subject matter in here. There are parts of it that are emotional, but almost every character in this book is someone who chose to stand up and just make a different kind of choice, to forgive instead of holding on to their anger, to take on the case of this girl who was seen as sort of an animal on death row, to see her as a human being who was desperately in need of help. You know, there was I didn't even mention how there were representatives of the Vatican flying into Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. There was a Franciscan friar wearing the hooded robe with the rope belt and everything, flew in from Rome, showed up at death row and said, you know, I would like to visit Paola Cooper, you know, and just trying to use their voices to get attention for her situation and for the issue. To me, that's extraordinary, and it ends up adding up. It ends up transforming part of our justice system. I started working on this shortly after Trump was elected into office, and you know, spoiler alert, I don't agree with his politics. But so this for me was a story that I could work on, mm-hmm. and feel some kind of hope on a daily basis, as tough as some of the material was. So on that note, you know, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Throughout the process of writing the book, what did you learn about forgiveness that you didn't understand or realize or comprehend prior to the process of writing this book?
That's a great question. You know, when I started working on the book, I really thought, this guy Bill, he may be a little unhinged, you know. I don't know. Would I have forgiven in his scenario? I still don't know. I consider myself generally an enlightened person, but I'm not sure. That said, in talking to Bill and other murder victims' family members I met along the way, one thing that really struck me is not only were some of them doing it out of their faith, but a lot of them were forgiving for their own survival. They felt so gripped at first by anger, depression, distress, by this idea, you know, that was really often bolstered by the prosecutor in their case, you know, we're going for the death penalty. Mm. And it really had kept them from finding a way to move forward in their lives. Some of these folks were drinking too much or doing drugs, lost their job, isolating themselves, getting upset with their family. They just didn't know how to function anymore. And so the forgiveness part was a way of saying, you know what, this act of violence can't own my life anymore. And I appreciated that aspect of it because that was something I could relate to. And they didn't need the perpetrator to accept their forgiveness. It was something about, you know, on their side, letting go and accepting for them that the fate of that person, it actually has a limited relationship to my memory of the person I lost. Mm-hmm. So that was a surprise for me and really moved me.
One of the folks that we've really grown to love in this movement is a woman named Reverend Sharon Risher. Her mother and family were killed by Dylann Roof. And one of the things I've heard her say is that I chose forgiveness not so that Dylann Roof can sleep at night, but so that I can sleep at night. I did not want to be held hostage to the same hatred that filled him.
So the forgiving process, right, you have the person doing the forgiveness, but then you also have the person receiving the forgiveness. So I'm thinking about Paula and, like, that process. So what did you see about her process of accepting that forgiveness and being forgiven? Like, how did she receive that? Like, the obstacles to receiving that? And then how did you see that transform her and her relationship with forgiveness, like the power of that in her life?
I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there was this tension at first when she heard from Bill. She was suspicious of him. So was her sister, Rhonda. It just struck them as off. You know, what is this guy up to? And I think that ultimately, however, you know, and I could see in the letters between them that the fact that he stayed in touch with her and he continued to offer his friendship, that he was sort of living out the forgiveness over time, is what made her accept the relationship as genuine, accept the gesture as genuine. I don't really know that Paula, you know, she understood at a certain point that he had forgiven her, but I don't know that Paula ever forgave herself, and that comes into play later in her life. So that was also something remarkable to think about, where, you know, she started to mature and evolve as a person, and that forgiveness from her victim's grandson didn't wipe away for her the process she had to go through within herself. Mm.
I've been careful too not to kind of intentionally not share how all of these stories end, because we want you to read the book and it's wonderful. But it's clear that, you know, Bill Pelkey would actually be up here. There's no doubt in my mind if he were still alive. But we did lose him. He died of a heart attack while shoveling snow not too long ago. So, but this book keeps his legacy alive, and it's a incredible gift to all of us, and I can't help but think he's smiling down on you and all of us as we continue this work. So I wanted to, you know, if there's any other, if anybody has a question, or if you have any, you know, closing thoughts that you want to leave people with, and you know, as you celebrate the release of this book this week.
I think that, you know, this is a book that ultimately, it's a story that has a tremendous amount of heart, and there's an incredibly unique relationship at the center of it. And I just was really honored to get to know everyone involved. It was an incredible experience over the last 5 years of research. So I'm excited to share it with you. And thank you so much for coming out.
I would say that if Bill Pelkey were here, he would send us out with a charge, which is that if you're not already involved in the movement for alternatives to the death penalty, there's a lot of ways to get involved. And one of those is the event that Bill started in Washington, D.C. Every summer for 4 days, there's a vigil on the steps of the Supreme Court. And it's the same week that the Supreme Court temporarily stopped the death penalty and executions. And that same week, several years later, ended up being when the Supreme Court allowed executions to continue. So we gather, it's the last week of June, in the beginning of July. And every evening we have a program, too. It's also live streamed, but we listen to people who have been impacted by the death penalty. And every 5 years, we do a direct action where we do a prayerful vigil. And Bill was one of the first that started that. That's the good trouble. That's where you get, might face arrest. But there's plenty of ways to get involved. And in Pennsylvania, we've got the Pennsylvanians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. We're trying to close the door on the death penalty in our state. We're one of those states that doesn't execute, thank God. But we still need to fully abolish the death penalty. Any other things you want to say about how people can be involved?
No, I think you covered it. That's a good takeaway.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Snuck
Thanks
in a
so
great
much
plug.
For this book. One more hand for Alex. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.